Chapter 20. Dark currents and swirling colours, unknowable beyond the gates of the Empyrean, flowed around the pride of the Emperor and her small complement of escorts as they forged a passage through the warp. Fulgrim's flagship bore fresh scars of war, but for all that her hull was imperfect, her magnificence was undimmed. The guns of the Iron Hands warships had left their marks upon her once pristine hull, but the shots had been fired in spite and futile defiance, for the broadsides fired by Fulgrim's warships had caught the Iron Hands completely by surprise. The battle had been short and one-sided, and though the vessels accompanying the Pride of the Emperor were few in number, they had inflicted crippling punishment on those of their former allies and disrupted their ability to respond in any meaningful way. Much to Marius Verosian's disappointment, Fulgrim had called a halt to the attack before the destruction of the Fist of Iron was complete. Leaving the crippled 10th Legion's fleet becalmed, the ships of the Emperor's children had disengaged and made the translation into the Immaterium to rendezvous with the forces of the Warmaster once more. Initially, things had gone as smoothly as could be hoped for, but barely a week into the journey to Istvan III, storms of fearsome power erupted in the warp. Tsunamis of unreality that crashed around the vessels of the 28th expedition and smashed one to destruction before the few surviving navigators had managed to fight their way through the storms and guide the ships to relative safety. Moments prior to the first maelstrom of force, terrifying shrieks of agony and terror had echoed the length and breadth of the Pride of the Emperor's astropathic choir chambers. Alarums had sounded, and one entire chancel was blown clear of the vessel by the force of the psychic forces unleashed, forks of purple lightning dancing across the hull before null shields and integrity fields had contained the breach. Hundreds of telepaths were dead, and those wretched ruins of flesh that survived were reduced to babbling, moronic psychotics. Before their elimination, those that retained some form of communication spoke of terrifying galaxy-changing forces unleashed, a world devoured by a monstrous, creeping death, fires that reached to the heavens, and the ending of billions of lives at a single stroke. Only Fulgrim and his coterie of most trusted warriors understood the truth behind these forces, and the feasting and carousing that greeted the news plumbed new depths of insanity. The Emperor's children revelled in the War Master's strength of purpose with the abandon that was now commonplace in the Legion. As the revelries of the Astartes continued, the preparations for Bequa Kinska's Maravigilia reached new heights of wonder and decadence, with each rehearsal discovering new and undreamt-of raptures to include. Coraline Seneca trod the boards nightly as she trained her voice to replicate the sounds recorded in the Lair Temple, and Bequa's symphony soared passionately as she sought to encapsulate its power in musical form. As part of her quest, she developed new and outlandish musical devices, their melodies as yet unheard and unknown. Such was their scale and form that they more resembled weapons than instruments. Monstrously oversized horns like missile tubes, and stringed mechanisms with long necks like rifles. La Fenice became a magical place of music and art, with the remembrancers working on the decor and embellishments of the theatre excelling themselves as they strove to create a venue worthy of staging the Maravigilia. Fulgrim spent a great deal of time in La Fenice, offering his insights to the artists and sculptors, and every suggestion was followed by frantic bouts of creativity as they were immediately implemented. Fragmentary scraps of information trickled in from Istvan III, and it was eventually discerned that the War Master's first strike against those whose loyalty remained with the Emperor had failed to wipe them out completely. Instead of viewing this as a setback, it appeared that the War Master had taken it as an opportunity to blood his loyal warriors and complete what had begun with the war against the Brotherhood of the Orishan Technocracy. warriors from the World Eaters. Death Guard and Sons of Horus were at war in the fire-racked ruins of a murdered world, hunting down and destroying the deluded fools who believed they could oppose the War Master's will. Even now, declared Fulgrim, Chaplain Charmosian and Lord Commander Eidolon would be earning the War Master's plaudits as they displayed the battle perfection of their beloved legion. When the killing on Isfahan III was done, the chaff would have been cut from Horus's force, and they would be a sharpened blade aimed at the heart of the corrupt Imperium. But the reunion of Fulgrim and Horus was to be delayed, it seemed. With the death of the majority of the astropaths, communication with the 63rd Expedition was problematic, to say the least, with the shattered sanity of those left alive making the precise exchange of information between the two fleets virtually impossible. The navigators could not discern a course through the warp, not racked with heaving currents and battering storms, and declared that it would take at least 2 months to reach Isfahan III. Fulgrim chafed at such delays, but even a being as mighty as a Primarch was powerless to quiet the tempests of the Immaterium. In the enforced wait, he studied more of the writings of Cornelius Blake, coming upon a passage that lodged like a splinter of ice in his heart. He tore the page from the book and burned it, but its words returned to haunt him as the dark voyage through the warp continued. The phoenix is an angel, the clapping of whose wings is the roar of thunder. And this thunder is the fearful note that heralds the cataclysm, and the roar of the onrushing waves that will destroy paradise. The sculpture was almost complete. What had begun many months ago as a gleaming white rectangle, hewn from the quarries at Proconnesus on the Anatolian Peninsula, was now a towering, majestic sculpture of the Emperor of the Imperium. Ostian's workshop was almost tidy, only the tiniest chips and flakes of marble drifting to the floor, for the last stage of his statue's journey was being wrought with files and rasps of greater and greater fineness. It had been said that the point of a journey was not to arrive, but to savour the experiences along the way. Ostian had never understood that aphorism, believing that only the end result made the journey worthwhile. To anyone else, the statue would have been finished some time ago, but Ostian had long ago realised that only in these final stages could be found that which would breathe the final life into the statue. At this crucial stage, a true artist would find the last twist of genius that lifted a statue from a thing of stone to a work of art. Whether that was in one last imperfection or a human understanding of the frailty of life, he didn't know, and didn't want to know, for Ostian feared that if he ever examined his talent too closely, he would be unable to piece it back together again. In the month since their journey to the Kalanides system, a pointless venture if ever there had been one, for the 28th expedition had tarried barely a week and fought in only one battle, as far as he could tell, he had kept himself more or less confined to his studio and the subdeck where meals were served. La Fenice had become a place of lewdness, where people who should know better drank too much, ate too much, and indulged their every sordid appetite without regard for the mores of civilized behaviour. The last few times he had visited La Fenice, he had been shocked and revolted by its appearance, the artwork and statuary taking on an altogether more sinister aspect as the Primarch lent his vision to the final details of its renovation. Wild, orgiastic gatherings like the debaucheries of the ancient Romani Empire were now a frequent occurrence, and Ostian had chosen to stay away rather than be outraged on a daily basis. The one time he had been forced to set foot in it, since he had shared a drink with Leopold Cadmus, a man who, along with almost every remembrancer who had not journeyed to Laren, appeared to have departed the 28th expedition, he had seen Fulgrim directing Serena Dangelus as she completed a great mural on the ceiling, Its proportions were monstrous, and its subject matter a vile concoction of writhing serpents and humans engaged in unimaginable excesses. Serena had spared him a brief glance, and he was ashamed as he remembered his harsh words to her when he had last visited her. Their eyes had met, and for a moment he had seen a look of such anguished desperation that he had wanted to weep when he later recalled it. Fulgrim had turned as though sensing his presence, and Ostian had been shocked rigid at the Primarch's appearance. Brightly coloured oils rimmed his eyes, and his silver hair was bound up in ludicrously tight plaits. The faint lines of what looked like tattoos curled on his cheeks, and his purple robe laid much of his pale flesh bare, revealing an inordinate number of fresh scars and silver rings or bars piercing the skin. Ostian was transfixed by Fulgrim's dark eyes, the madness and driving obsession he had seen in his studio magnified to terrifying proportions. The memory chilled him, and he retuned his attention to the marble. Perhaps the remembrances that had vanished from the 28th expedition to greener pastures had the right idea, though a suspicious voice in the back of his head worried that some darker reason lay behind the sudden lack of dissenting voices. Even the thought of such a suspicion was enough, and Ostian resolved that as soon as he found the spark of humanity that brought the statue to life, he would request a transfer to another expedition. The flavour of the 28th had become sour to him. "The sooner I'm out of here, the better," he whispered to himself. Though he could not know of it, Ostian Delafour's sentiment echoed Solomon Demeter's almost exactly, as he stared over the bombed-out ruins of the Coral City and the Precentor's palace. The desolate, fire-blackened landscape stretched out before him as far as the eye could see, as close to a vision of hell as he could ever imagine. This had once been a beautiful world. The obliterated perfection of its architecture in stark contrast to the rebellion that had fermented within its gilded palaces and the treachery that played out in its blackened remains. A dark shroud had hung over Solomon ever since the battle on the deep orbital of the Calanides system, though the reason for Julius and Marius's abandonment of the second was now horribly apparent. He had seen neither of his brothers following the battle, and within hours he and the second had been in transit to the Istvan system to rendezvous with three other legions to pacify the rebellious world of Istvan III. The heart of the rebellion was centred on a city of polished granite and tall spires of steel and glass known as the Coral City. Its corrupt governor, Vardas Prahl, had fallen under the influence of the War Singers, rogue psychers that had supposedly been wiped out by the Raven Guard Legion over a decade ago. Initial attacks on the Coral City had washed away many of Solomon's feelings of unease, the release of his anger and hurt in bloodshed reassuring him that things were as they should be, and that his earlier misgivings were no cause for concern. Then Saul Tarvitz had arrived with an incredible tale of betrayal and imminent attack. Many had scoffed at Tarvitz's warning, but Solomon had immediately known the truth of it, and had fought to make his brothers realize their danger. As the monstrous scale of the betrayal sank in, the sons of Horus, world-eaters and emperor's children had raced to find shelter before the deadly viral payload struck the world intended to be their tomb. Solomon had watched in horror as the first streaks of light lit up the sky and the detonations covered the skies in thick starbursts of deadly viral agents. The screaming of the city as it died haunted him still, and he couldn't even begin to imagine the horror that must have filled the minds of those who watched as the Life Eater devoured the flesh of their loved ones before reducing them to disintegrated hunks of rotted dead matter. Solomon knew how deadly the Life Eater was, and he knew that within hours the entire planet would be a charnel house. Then the firestorm had come and razed the surface bare of any signs of its former inhabitants, burning them to ashen flakes on the wind as it destroyed all in its path and howled across the surface of Istvan III in a seething tide of flame. He shut his eyes as he remembered the underground bunker that had sheltered both himself and Gaius Kafen from the viral attack, finally yielding to the molten heat of the firestorm. The roar of the fire had been like that of some ancient dragon of legend come to devour him, and the agony, as his armour melted in the heat and seared his flesh, was still fresh in his consciousness. Trapped beneath the rubble, they had called for help, but no one had come, and Solomon had wondered whether they were the only survivors of the War Master's treachery. On the third day, Gaius Kafen had died, his injuries finally claiming him as sunlight filtered into their prison of rubble. Eventually, Solomon had been found by one of the sons of Horus, a warrior named Nero Vipus. Barely breathing, but clinging to life with the tenacity of one who refuses to die until he has had his vengeance. The first month of the battles that followed the failed viral attack had passed in a blur of agony and nightmares, his life hanging in the balance until Saul Tarbitz had come to him and promised that he would make the traitors pay for their betrayal. Seeing the fires of ambition finally lit within the young warrior had galvanized Solomon, and his recovery had been nothing short of miraculous. An apothecary named Vadon had found time, between treating the wounded, to bring him back from the brink, and as the war ground onwards, Solomon found his strength returning to the point where he was able to fight once more. Taking the armour of the dead, Solomon had risen phoenix-like from what many had considered to be his deathbed, and had fought on with all the ferocity and courage for which he was renowned. Saul Tarbitz had immediately offered to transfer command to him, but he had refused, knowing that the surviving warriors of all the legions looked to Tarbitz for leadership. To usurp that would be pointless, especially now that their heroic defiance of betrayal was almost at an end. The massed forces of the War Master had driven them back into the heart of the palace, and the sons of Horus had committed their best warriors to the assault. Solomon knew the end was not far off, and had no wish to deprive Tarbitz of the glory of his last stand. To Solomon's surprise, Tarbitz had not been the only warrior to excel in the crucible of this desperate combat, but the swordsman Lucius had also performed wonders, taking the head of Chaplain Charmosian in a duel atop the traitor's land raider for all to see. As gratifying as it was to see these warriors come into their own, it was but a shadow compared to the anguish of Kafen's death, and the revulsion he felt at what had become of their former battle brothers. How could it have come to this, that warriors who had once stood shoulder to shoulder in forging the Emperor's realm could be locked in a bloody fight to the death? What had happened to drive them to this? It was beyond his understanding, and the aching hollowness inside him could not be filled with the deaths of his enemies. The dream of a galaxy for mankind to inherit was dying with his treachery, and the golden future that awaited them was slipping out of reach forever. Solomon grieved for the future of grim darkness that was being hammered out on the anvil of Istvan III, and hoped that those who would come after them would forgive them for what they had allowed to happen. He hoped the future would remember the warriors around him for the heroes they were, but most of all, he hoped that Nathaniel Garrow's Eisenstein could escape this trap and take word of the War Master's treachery to the Emperor. Tarbitz had told of his honour brother and how he had seized the frigate and sworn to return with the loyalist legions to crush Horus utterly. That hope, that tiny flickering ember of belief in salvation, had kept the warriors defending the shattered ruins of the Precentor's palace, fighting long after logic and reason would have otherwise dictated. Solomon loved each and every one of them for their heroism. The distant thump of a bombardment drifted from the western reaches of the city, where the scattered remnants of the Death Guard hunkered down in the face of near-constant shelling from the traitor forces. Solomon limped through the eastern reaches of the palace, the once mighty colonnades little more than a series of empty, mosaic-floored chambers, whose furnishings had long since been dragged out to form ad hoc barricades. The domes of the chambers had miraculously remained intact, despite the months of shelling, the blackened walls and scorched frescoes, an infinitely sad reminder that this had once been an imperial world. When he heard the sounds, they were faint at first, barely registering over the ever-present crackle of flames and relentless booms of explosions. The clash of blades quickly penetrated the dull miasma of war, and Solomon picked up his pace as he realized that the eastern approaches to the palace must be under attack. Solomon ran as fast as his injuries would allow him, the pain of his burnt flesh acute, rendering his every footfall agonizing. The sound of battle grew more strident, and he could pick out the sharp clang of sword blades, though he dimly registered that there was no gunfire, no explosions. The sounds came from ahead. Solomon skidded into a brightly lit dome, sunlight catching on the blades of the warriors who battled within. Captain Lucius commanded this sector of the defences with around 30 warriors, and Solomon saw the lithe figure of the swordsman at the centre of a tremendous battle. Bodies littered the floor, and a struggling mass of Emperor's children filled the dome, surrounding Lucius as he fought for his life. "Lucius!" cried Solomon, raising his weapon and rushing to the swordsman's aid. A flash of steel licked out, and a warrior fell, cloven from neck to groin by the energized edge of Lucius's blade. "They're breaking in, Solomon!" shouted Lucius gleefully, taking the head from another of his attackers with a deadly high cut.
"Not while I have my strength, they won't,"
bellowed Solomon, swinging his blade at the nearest of the attackers. His blow smashed the traitor to the ground in a welter of blood and shattered armour.
"Kill them all," shouted Lucius.
"You dare return to me in failure?"
bellowed Horus, the bridge of the vengeful spirit shaking with the fury of his voice. His face twisted in anger, and Fulgrim smiled as he watched the War Master struggle to hold his chthonic fury in check. The vengeful spirit had changed a great deal since Fulgrim had last stood in the War Master's inner sanctum, its once open and brightly lit hubbub replaced with something far darker.
"Do you even understand what I am trying to do here?" continued Horus. "What I have started at Istvan will consume the whole galaxy, and if it is flawed from the outset, then the Emperor will break us."
Fulgrim allowed a smile of delicious insouciance to surface on his face, the excitement of finally arriving at Istvan III and the scale of the carnage wrought below, stimulating his taste for the excessive. Though the pride of the Emperor had but recently arrived, Fulgrim had been careful to appear before the War Master as magnificent as ever, his exquisite armour worked with fresh layers of vivid purples and gold, with many new embellishments and finery added to complement the bright colours. His long white hair was pulled back, and his pale cheeks were marked with the beginnings of tattoos that Serena D'Angelus had designed for him.
"Ferus Manus is a dull fool who would not listen to reason," said Fulgrim. "Even the mention of the Mechanicum's pledge did not—"
"You swore to me that you could sway him. The Iron Hands were essential to my plans. I planned Istvan III with your assurance that Ferus Manus would join us. Now I find that I have yet another enemy to contend with. A great many of our Astartes will die because of this, Fulgrim."
"What would you have had me do, War Master?"
smiled Fulgrim, being sure to twist his words with a sly, mocking tone.
"His will was stronger than I anticipated."
"Or you simply had an inflated opinion of your own abilities."
"Would you have had me kill our brother, War Master?"
asked Fulgrim, hoping that Horus would not ask such a thing of him, but knowing that it was what he wanted to hear.
"For I will, if that is what you desire of me."
"Perhaps I do," replied Horus, unmoved. It would be better than leaving him to roam free to destroy our plans. As it is, he could reach the Emperor or one of the other Primarchs and bring them all down on our heads before we are ready.
Then, if you are quite finished with me, I shall return to my legion, said Fulgrim, turning away with a flourish calculated to infuriate the War Master. He was not to be disappointed, and felt his heart pound as Horus said,
No, you will not. I have another task for you. I am sending you to Istvan V. With all that has happened, the Emperor's response is likely to arrive more quickly than anticipated, and we must be prepared for it. Take a detail of Emperor's children to the alien fortresses there, and prepare it for the final phase of the Istvan operation.
Fulgrim recoiled and turned back to his brother, the disgust at such a menial role horrifying and repugnant, the exquisite sensations flooding his body at his baiting of the War Master faded and left him hollow inside.
You would consign me to the role of Castellan, as some housekeeper making your property ready for your grand entrance? Why not send for Pertirabo? This kind of thing is more to his liking.
Pertirabo has his own role to play, said Horus. Even now, he prepares to lay waste to his home world in my name. We shall be hearing more of our bitter brother very soon. Have no fear of that.
Then give this task to Mortarion, spat Fulgrim. His grimy footsluggers will relish an opportunity to muddy their hands for you. My legion was the chosen of the Emperor in the years when he still deserved our service. I am the most glorious of his heroes, and the right hand of this new crusade. This is a betrayal of the very principles of which I chose to join you, Horus.
Betrayal, said Horus, his voice low and dangerous. A strong word, Fulgrim. Betrayal is what the Emperor forced upon us when he abandoned the galaxy to pursue his quest for godhood, and gave over the conquests of our crusade to scriveners and bureaucrats. Is that the charge you would level at me, to my face, on the bridge of my own ship?
Fulgrim stepped back, his anger fading as he felt Horus's rage wash over him, relishing the crawling sensations that filled him at the excitement of the confrontation.
Perhaps I do, Horus. Perhaps someone needs to tell you a few home truths, now that your precious Mournival is no more.
That sword, said Horus, indicating the venom-sheened weapon that Fulgrim had been given at their last meeting. I gave you that blade as a symbol of my trust in you, Fulgrim. We alone know the true power that lies within it. That weapon almost killed me, and yet I gave it away. Do you think I would give such a weapon to one I do not trust?
No, War Master, said Fulgrim.
Exactly. The Istvan V phase of my plan is the most critical, said Horus, and Fulgrim could feel the War Master's superlative diplomatic skills coming to the fore as the dangerous embers of his ego were fanned. Even more so than what is happening below us. I can entrust it to no other. You must go to Istvan V, my brother. All depends on your success.
Fulgrim let the violent potential crackling between them continue for a long, frightening moment before laughing.
And now you flatter me, hoping my ego will coerce me into obeying your orders.
Is it working? Asked Horus.
Yes, admitted Fulgrim. Very well, the War Master's will be done. I will go to Istvan V.
Eidolon will stay in command of the Emperor's children until we join you, said Horus, and Fulgrim nodded.
He will relish the chance to prove himself further, said Fulgrim.
Now leave me, Fulgrim, said Horus. You have work to do.
Fulgrim turned smartly and marched from the War Master's presence, his breathing coming in shallow bursts as he replayed the violent potential of the near confrontation and allowed the memory of his brother's anger once more to stimulate his senses. The feeling was sublime, and he imagined greater and headier delights ahead when the Istvan V portion of the War Master's plan came to fruition. Such horrors, such death, such delights.
Solomon drove his roaring blade through the chest plate of the warrior before him, twisting the weapon savagely as it tore through the layers of ceramite, flesh and bone. Blood sprayed from the ghastly wound, and the traitor crashed to the tiled floor. He spun painfully to find another opponent, but the only figure left standing was Lucius, his scarred face flushed with the energy of the battle. Solomon checked to make sure there were no survivors, before finally lowering his sword and acknowledging the pain of his many wounds. Blood dripped from his sword as the whirring teeth slowly wound to a halt, and he took a deep breath as he saw how close they had come to being overwhelmed. The skill with which the swordsman had dispatched his foes bordered on the miraculous, and Solomon knew that Lucius's reputation as the deadliest killer in the Legion was entirely justified.
"We did it," he gasped,
painfully aware of how dearly the victory had been bought. All the warriors under Lucius's command were dead, and as Solomon surveyed the carnage, he felt an immense sorrow as he saw that there was little to tell traitor from loyalist. But for a twist of fate, might he too have turned on his brethren?
"We did indeed, Captain Demeter," smirked Lucius. "I couldn't have done it without you."
Solomon looked up at the supercilious tone and bit back an angry retort. He shook his head at the swordsman's ingratitude and nodded wearily.
"Strange they came with so few warriors," he said,
kneeling beside the body of the last traitor he had killed.
"What did they think to gain?"
"Nothing," said Lucius, cleaning the blood from his sword with a scrap of cloth. "Yet."
"What do you mean?" demanded Solomon,
fast growing weary of Lucius's obtuse answers. The swordsman smiled, but didn't answer, and Solomon looked away, taking in the dead bodies and the stench of seared flesh and bone.
"Don't worry, Solomon," said Lucius. "It will all soon become clear to you."
The smug gleam in the swordsman's eyes unnerved Solomon more than he cared to admit, and a horrific, gut-wrenching suspicion began to form in his mind. He quickly looked around the dome, his eyes darting back and forth as he did a quick count of the bodies that lay silent and unmoving on the cratered floor. Lucius had been given the remains of 4 squads to defend this portion of the palace, some 30 warriors.
"Oh, no," whispered Solomon, as he realized that there were around 30 corpses.
He gazed at the battered armor plates, the blackened faces, and the damage that told him these warriors had not come fresh from their billets to attack the palace, but had been here all along. These dead warriors were not traitors at all.
"They were loyalists," he whispered.
"I'm afraid so," said Lucius. "I am going to rejoin the Legion. The price for that is allowing Eidolon and his warriors a way into the palace. It was most fortunate you arrived when you did, Captain Demeter. I do not know if I would have been able to kill them all before the Lord Commander arrives."
Solomon felt the walls of his existence come crashing down as the enormity of what he had done sank in. He dropped to his knees, and tears of horror and anguish spilled down his cheeks.
"No. What have you done, Lucius?" he cried. "You have doomed us all."
Lucius laughed and said,
"You were already doomed, Solomon. I just hastened the end."
Solomon hurled aside his sword in disgust at what he had become, a killer, no better than the traitors beyond the palace, and his anger at Lucius surged like a molten river.
"You took my honour from me," he snarled,
rising to his feet and turning to face the swordsman.
"It was all I had left."
Lucius was right in front of him, that cocky, arrogant smile still plastered over his scarred features. The swordsman smiled and asked,
"How does it feel?" Solomon roared and flew at Lucius, wrapping his hands around his foe's neck. Hate and remorse flooded his limbs with fresh energy to better strangle the life from this thief of honour. A terrible pain erupted in his stomach, tearing upwards through his chest, and Solomon cried out as his ruined frame fell away from Lucius. He looked down to see the glowing blade of Lucius's sword protruding from his breastplate. The sizzle of burning meat and melting ceramite was strong in his nostrils as Lucius thrust his sword completely through his torso. The strength fled from his body, and all the agony of the injuries he had fought to overcome since the firestorm returned 100-fold. His entire body was a mass of pain, his every nerve ending shrieking in agony. Solomon dropped to his knees, his blood and life pouring from his body in a hot rush. He reached up to grip Lucius's arms and fought to focus on the swordsman's face as death reached up to claim him.
"You will not win," he gasped, each word forced from his throat a small victory.
Lucius shrugged. "Maybe, maybe not. But you won't be around to see it." Solomon fell backwards in slow motion, feeling the motion of air across his face and the crack of his skull against the hard floor. He rolled onto his back, looking out through the cracked dome to the clear blue sky beyond. He smiled as the pain balms of his armour struggled uselessly to alleviate the mortal wound Lucius's blade had done to him, staring into the limitless expanse of the open sky, and feeling as though his gaze might reach beyond the atmosphere to where Horus's fleet hung in space. With a clarity denied him in life, Solomon saw where the War Master's terrible betrayal would inevitably lead, the horror and the long war that would surely follow. Tears spilled down his cheeks, but they were not shed for his own ending, but for the billions who would suffer an eternity of darkness for the sake of one man's dreadful ambition. Lucius walked away from him, not even bothering to watch his final moments, and Solomon was glad of the peace. His breathing slowed, and his eyelids flickered as the sky grew darker with each breath. The light was dying with him, he thought, as though the world marked his passing by drawing a curtain across the day and ushering him into the final darkness with honour. Solomon closed his eyes as a final tear fell to the ground.